My friends, what is the hardest job in the world? Anybody know? Well, I'm going to tell you what it is. It's loving people. It's loving people. I've heard many explanations as to what constitutes real love. There are more preconceptions and misconceptions about this than what you could shake a stick at. I really think that one of the finest things that God can do is to show us just what real love is all about. You see, love is not what we may have always imagined it to be. Most people think of love as a warm and fuzzy feeling for someone else. And it's commonly believed that if you don't feel good or affectionate or compassionate toward another, you don't love that person. But this is a definition of human love, but it's a false definition of Christian love. Christian love is not merely an emotion. Christian love is an attitude, a consciously chosen attitude of a mind given over to God. It's a mindset and a determined set of a will, of our wills, submitted to God. In simple terms, loving is using one's God-given power of choice to do that which is in the best interest and for the best good of another person, regardless of our feelings. So then what I'm saying is that pure and holy affection is not a feeling. What is it? It is a principle. The Lord's supreme command is not that you shall feel loving, but you shall love. And as long as our mind continues to function, we can obey that command. Many struggling Christians are greatly concerned about how they feel towards God. They're disappointed and discouraged because they never seem to experience the depth of feeling that they think that a Christian should have toward Him. And they feel guilty because the amount of affection and the degree of warmth that they have for God is often so slight. Those in this dilemma know that they're supposed to love God more than anything or anyone else in the world. And yet somehow they cannot manage to develop even the amount of feeling that they have for somebody else, no matter how hard they try to do this. Many have become so discouraged over this that they've given up Christianity. Now they figure they never would be able to care as much about God as they felt that they should or that they were supposed to. So they assumed that there was no hope for them. So they threw in the towel and gave it up. Friends, I've had these thoughts myself. And I have to admit that I have a deeper emotional attachment for my wife than I do for God. I often feel warmer and more affectionate toward her than I do toward God. My feelings for her definitely have a greater emotional strength than do my feelings for God. But in spite of this fact, I have used and I continue to use the power of my mind to put God first. I put Him first in my life daily. I have decided, and I continue to decide, to put God ahead of myself, my wife, and even my children. And I know now that this means one important thing. I love God the most. If there ever were a conflict between doing my wife's will for me and what is God's will, I would want to choose to put God's wishes above my wife's. Do you see then, though my emotional affection for my wife might be greater, my love for God is deeper and greater. Through the use of my will and by my actions, I demonstrate the priority I've chosen to give my Lord in my life. He is number one. He comes ahead of my wife, my children, my friends, anybody else. God comes first. Now, this is the only possible way to love those people who do absolutely nothing for us emotionally, or who even cause us to have negative feelings towards them. This is how Jesus was able to persist in loving those who spit on Him. Those who drew His blood with a scourge, with a whip. And those devil-possessed humans who murdered Him. You see, His actions and words said clearly to those despicable wretches, "You can do anything you wish to me, but remember, nothing, absolutely nothing you can do to me will be enough to make me stop loving you." And when the final crisis came, Jesus did not have some burning passion or some longing desire to be separated from His relationship with the Father and to die for totally unappealing, totally undeserving sinners like us. As a matter of fact, Jesus prayed for a way not to have to go through with the ultimate sacrifice. Matthew 26, verse 39. My friends, the greatest act of love that the universe has ever known and ever seen was not based on feelings. By this unparalleled act, Jesus demonstrated to all people for all time what love really is. And this divine example compels us to go right on choosing to love those whom we may have no feeling for, even those who may oppose us, no matter what they may do or say to us, or no matter how hateful they may become. We should never stop loving them. Now this seems almost impossible, doesn't it? It's beyond our understanding how to do this. But it is a distinct part of the mystery of godliness, which the Bible speaks about. Try as we might, our human hearts can never produce it. And yet, in spite of this, Jesus said, "Love your enemies." His command carries with it the assurance that we really can successfully keep on loving when we feel like hating. God will give us the power to act toward everyone in love just as He did. And I want to tell you, brothers and sisters, every one of us are going to face this someday in our own personal lives. It's going to happen. So Christian loving, then, is a matter of mind over feelings. With the mind of Jesus in him, a person becomes free to choose the sort of unconditional, persistent love that can be limited by no kind of emotion. A Christian then becomes free to act always in love toward others rather than reacting in response to their unloveliness. You see, too many of us, we react. Instead of acting, we react. You understand what I'm saying? Someone does something, and immediately we react. Usually in the wrong way. The Bible shows God's love for people in action on their behalf. Jesus knew that He could reveal the love of God best by putting it in the form of dynamic action. He went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed by the devil, Acts 10:38. Now, this challenging lifestyle the Lord has in mind for His followers today. He wants you and me to love actively. Jesus did good for no other reason than that He was good. To this kind of love and to this kind of doing, He calls you and me. All too often, the good that you and I are prompted to do is based on some ulterior motive. We do good for someone because they've done something to us, something nice to us, so we want to reciprocate. We do good for someone because we know we should, and we would feel guilty if we didn't do it. Or worse yet, we might do good for someone in order to put them in a position of owing us a favor so that we can then exert the pressure that will manipulate them into doing what we want them to do or into becoming what we want them to become. Now, if we're going to love as Jesus did, we will never, never be found doing good in order to get our own way or in order to be rewarded. Jesus did not make friends to get them to come to church. Is that what we do? Jesus didn't make friends to get them to come to church. He did not heal them or do good to them to get them to join His movement. That wasn't why He did it. Many did join, to be sure. But their response was not the determining factor in His doing good for them. Christian love is simply an act of the kind God once performed for another person's health and wellness and wholeness to help fulfill His will for that person. And our performing that act in Christ's perspective and concern is the love, not my warm feeling about doing it. Make sense? Friends, kindness is a kingly quality. It is love in action. It is love in working clothes. A true Christian will be kind. Indeed, the explicit command, "Be ye kind," Ephesians 4:32, is a command of divine authority. And yet, because of unkindness, many hearts are made to ache. Many homes are broken up, and many church troubles have their origin there. As a matter of fact, aren't all the tragic troubles of the human race caused by unkindness? We look out upon a world today littered with a wreckage of hate and unkindness. We see a war-weary world rubbing sad, tired eyes, bloodshot with weeping. The creeping paralysis of fear is clutching at the hearts of people everywhere. The iron curtain of doubt, suspicion, fear, and frustration is slowly settling down upon the world. Armageddon and doomsday hang by a thread right over our heads. If ever the world needed to hear the doctrine of kindness, it is today. But who? I want to ask you this question. Who is to preach that doctrine? Don't tell me the pastor. All of us. Every single one of us, when we profess the name of Christ, we are to preach that doctrine. How? From the pulpit? By the way we live. By our actions. Remember, our actions speak louder than words. "Be ye kind" is a clarion call of God that comes ringing down the corridors of time. It's a divine command, but here is our tragedy. We are so accustomed to look for profound solutions to our problems that we often overlook some of the simple practices. We seem to want some ultra formula that'll solve all the problems of the church, the home, the school, the community, and the whole world, and pass by the simple formula of Christ: "Be ye kind." Friends, are we kind? Listen to this. Listen to the pen of inspiration. If we would humble ourselves before God and be kind and courteous and tender-hearted and pitiful, there will be 100 conversions to the truth where now there is only one. Isn't that a staggering statement? Notice that it doesn't say that if we were kind, there might be or could be or should be 100 conversions where now there is only one. No. It says there would be. It is a divine promise, brothers and sisters. As a pastor, I am interested in anything that will increase our soul-winning potential 100-fold. And if kindness will bring about such a wave of evangelism, I'm for it 100%. How about you? My friends, the principle of being kind not only has a spiritual significance, but it has a very definite psychological as well as physiological significance. Dr. Parrish tells us that the health of the world, the individual, and the community will be far better if it were not for so much petty meanness. He says the physical is largely influenced or dominated by the mental health. Now, friends, here is a doctor that is telling us that unkindness is cruel and is robbing the world of health and happiness. He further says, an unkind word by the husband to the wife, or the wife to the husband, a brief flare-up between brother or sister, an unnecessary rebuff by a departmental leader to his subordinate, may ruin an entire day and perhaps be the turning point in the lives of a number of persons. Now, this statement by Dr. Parrish should stab us all awake. It reminds us of the inspired statement of God's servant who wrote, "The inhumanity of man to man is our greatest sin." And here comes a doctor confirming it. Unkindness is a cruel killer. War has killed its thousands, but unkindness has killed its tens of thousands. Furthermore, being kind not only helps people, other people, but it actually does something to the person who is being kind. If you don't believe the philosophy of Christ when he says this, go down the road where you live and find the most unhappy person in your neighborhood and do something kind for them. It'll be an experience of happy discovery. Now, there's a confirmation of this principle found in Christian Service, where it says, doing good is an excellent remedy for disease. I want you to notice that it doesn't say that doing good is just a remedy, but that it is an excellent remedy. How many doctors prescribe home missionary work as a remedy for disease? Probably not many. Do you suppose we have something yet to learn about psychosomatic treatment? We do. But why, you may ask, why should the act of doing kind things to others be an excellent remedy for disease? Well, here's the answer from the same inspired authority. The pleasure of doing good to others imparts a glow to the feelings, which flashes through the nerves, quickens the circulation of the blood, and induces mental and physical health. If you're not feeling good, if you're having troubles physically, maybe we ought to consider getting involved in community services. Of course, you don't have to join community services to do that. Anyone who has neighbors or families can do that. Dr. Mayo of the famous Mayo Clinic left this testimony for all of us to ponder. He said, "The world needs religion. I have seen patients who are dead by all medical standards. We knew they wouldn't live, but I've seen a minister come to the bedside of such a patient and do something for him that I couldn't do, although I had done everything professionally in my power. But something touched some immortal spark in him, and in defiance of materialistic common sense, he lived." My friends, kindness not only helps the individual physically, mentally, and spiritually, but it also helps in the home, the church, and the community. It really works. It works wonders in our old world. There was our good Adventist sister back there in the Middle States. Her husband was a drunkard. Every night he'd be found down with his cronies, down at the bar, drinking. Yet that Adventist wife prayed on, hoped on, day after day, week after week, year after year, claiming this promise that if she would only be kind, something would happen. Those of you who live in a home with only one Christian and you're married, listen up, because what I'm telling you actually happened. And I could give you numerous other cases in my own personal experience with church members that would verify this. Oh, my friends, how long do we pray? Do we let go of the arm of the Lord too soon? I want to tell you, God will not fail His own elect who cry unto Him day and night. He will reward them speedily. And when the hour came, how speedy it was, to her own surprise and in such a strange way. This dear lady was still so kind and helpful, and yet that man went on from bad to worse. Until one night. It was midnight. He was down with his cronies, drinking himself drunk down there at the bar, and they got into an argument, as men often will do. Why? Why will people put an enemy like alcohol into their mouth to steal away their brains as well as their health? People who are ordinarily good and kind often turn into beasts without poison in their systems. So there they were arguing, and of all things to be arguing about, they were arguing as to who had the best wife. Each man said he had the best wife. And finally this man spoke up and said, "You fellows don't know what you're even talking about. I have the best wife in the world." They looked at him. "What do you mean?" "I mean what I say. If you don't believe it, come over to the house and I'll show you." "Why, it's after midnight. We wouldn't dare go." "It doesn't matter what time it is. Come over right now and I'll show you." Those old drunk fellers staggered down the street, got up the steps and went into the house. And he called upstairs with an oath to his wife to come down. She awoke and said, "Just a minute, dear, I'll be right down." And then she had to change her clothes and put a dress on, and it took her a moment. Again he called up with an oath, and he cursed her again. "I told you to come down here, hurry up." "It's all right, dear, I'm coming right down." As she came down, those other men looked on amazed at the difference from what they had seen in their homes. He said, "We're hungry. We want something to eat. These are my friends." She said, "All right, I'll be glad to get them something to eat. Just go in and sit down in the living room, and I'll be right in." She rushed into the kitchen, and in a few minutes, the aroma of food came wafting through. And then she got the tray. She came into the hall, and just then the front door closed. The men were on the outside. "Why," she said, "I thought your friends were hungry." "What's the matter?" "Oh, that isn't why I brought them here." "Well, maybe I misunderstood, dear. I'm sorry, I thought they wanted something to eat." "Well, that's what I said, but it isn't what I meant. I wanted to show them something." "What did you want to show them?" So then he had to come out with it. "Well, we were arguing over there as to who had the best wife, and I told them I had the best wife in the world, and they wouldn't believe me. But after they came over here just now, they said they didn't need any more evidence. So they've gone." And then he looked at her. Now, I'm telling you the truth. He looked at her and he said, "Dear, how is it that you can be so kind to me when I am so mean to you?" Now she had her chance. She said, "Husband, Jesus is coming soon. And my happiness will begin then. I will never have another headache nor another heartache. You're not planning to go to heaven at all. So I know your happiness will not last very long. And what little you ever have will only be for a few years here. And I'm trying to give you a little bit of happiness. I'm trying to do it, for I know yours won't last long. And mine will begin and never end. I'm going to heaven when Jesus comes." That man heard those words and it sobered him up. He looked full into her face and he said, "If you're going to heaven, I'm going to heaven with you. I'm going to stop drinking. I will never take another drink. And brothers and sisters, that man has kept that his word. He began studying the Bible and going to Sabbath school and church. And I'm happy to tell you that he was baptized. And he and his wife began to have a little bit of heaven on earth in their home instead of the living hell it was for all those years. Friends, why shouldn't the community services be the first to help out every family stricken by sorrow? Why not be the first at every fire to help the family that's been burned out? Why shouldn't we, the Seventh-day Adventist Community Services, or the Seventh-day Adventist Church, it's more than just community services, why shouldn't we be the Good Samaritans of these latter days? Thank God it's coming. Listen, before the final visitation of God's judgments upon the earth, there will be among the people of the Lord such a revival of primitive godliness as has not been witnessed since apostolic times. Brothers and sisters, it is coming. It's a divine prophecy. The world will yet see the greatest revelation of the Christian virtues of love and kindness since the days of the apostles. And truly, the world needs today what it needed 2,000 years ago. A revelation of Jesus Christ in the Midtown Church, as well as all the other Adventist churches. And remember, Jesus was kind. He went about doing good. Acts 10:38. Now, as we've talked about kindness, we've seen that it involves the divine command, be ye kind. It involves the divine promise. If we were kind, there would be 100 conversions to the truth, where now there's only one. It involves a divine indictment. Our unkindness is our greatest sin. It involves a divine prophecy. We shall yet see a revival of primitive godliness as has not been witnessed since apostolic times. My friends, this primitive godliness, this love of Jesus in the human heart, is the greatest fire ever kindled on this earth. But remember, kindness is love at work. Then let us practice kindness and conquer with Christ. Loving kindness transforms our hovels of hate into havens of happiness. Kindness is the magic key that unlocks every human heart. Kindness is the evidence of kingliness.